Hey everyone, back again. Today we're going to continue Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem with chapters 4 through 7. Before jumping into this, you know the whole spiel. If not, like, or, you know, if you don't, you should go listen to part 1, because it means you haven't listened to part 1. Please consider donating to one of the organizations I've listed below. If you can, any kind of pressure you can mount against any institution that you might be a part of, work in, your workplace. If they have any investments with Israel, this is something that you can put pressure on them to try and divest from Israel. There is no reason that our labor is being used and funneled off in the form of surplus value to fund Israel's violence against Palestinians. And this is a labor issue. Therefore, if you are part of a union, it is a union issue. Just blows my mind. You know, there's infinite money for these wars, but no money for healthcare, you know? No money for education, no money for school supplies, no money to shelter the houseless. You know, it's just amazing. Amazing how that works. But yeah, here we're going to continue from chapter 4, the first solution, expulsion. And here she's going to begin by outlining the three solutions to the quote-unquote Jewish question that the Nazis had adopted. The Jewish question, of course, extending far earlier, far long before the Nazis, where anti-Semitism was rampant all throughout Europe for centuries before the Nazis. But these three strategies, these three solutions go in the following order, where the first solution was expulsion, just sending Jews away. And it's in this stage that the Nazis and the Zionists really made good bedfellows. From there, transformed into concentration was the second solution, and then into the final solution in the form of extermination. Now, the actual extermination of Jewish people didn't just start in the quote-unquote final solution. In different parts of Europe, it was taking place long before. Germany, Hungary, Romania, where executing Jewish people was almost like, as horrendous as it is, like a pastime in many places. And so these were the broad adopted strategies by the Nazis and solutions and maneuvers by the Nazis, but they are not indicative or totally determinative of the anti-Semitic treatment, violence against Jews and Roma people and disabled people during the Nazi regime. And one of the things that haunts Hannah Arendt here, and I think I've mentioned it, is that, like, she asks, how was it so easy for the Nazis to accomplish these goals? And she identifies, and we're going to go through it more, but she identifies how Jewish elders, prominent Jewish figures, were largely aiding the Nazis to help them in their coordinated effort to round up Jewish people. And she will go on to show here that if there was just the tiniest bit of resistance, then the Nazis wouldn't have been able to actually accomplish their goals. One of her more incendiary remarks is that if Jewish leaders and elders did not help the Nazis, then there is no way this many Jews would have died, between 5 and 6 million at the time, you know, before, you know, now we know more, definitely closer to 6 million. And this extends far beyond just Jewish leaders' participation with the Nazis, where non-Jewish leaders as well could have put in an iota of resistance. And there are many examples, like Denmark, Italy, even France, Sweden, countries that were just like, nah, we're not going to do that, and saved most of their Jewish population. Like, it was possible, but that's not what happened. And this is part of the story that often gets covered up. And I don't mean that in like a deliberate way, but something, I mean, in like the Heideggerian kind of way of like, whatever. But in the way of like concealing something, I don't know, it's something that just gets ignored about this part of the story, because it demonstrates just how widespread anti-Semitism was, and also that the Nazis were like less powerful than they're made out to seem. And it required a lot of cooperation by Jewish and non-Jewish officials to actually allow them to accomplish their goals. So, the first solution, expulsion. Eichmann had this to say about his view of the Jews. That solution I envisaged as putting firm soil under their feet so that they would have a place of their own, soil of their own. It was also the kind of solution that was approved by the Jewish people. Now in court, in the Jerusalem court, they recognized that he had saved thousands and thousands, maybe into the hundreds of thousands of Jews by adopting this strategy, by working with Zionists to send Jews to Palestine. And as Arendt would say later, these Jews, these Zionist Jews, would actually enjoy a lot of privilege. They would actually be able to freely move throughout Nazi Germany, interestingly enough, which flies in the face of the narrative that Eichmann was just an absolute hater of Jewish people, like the ultimate anti-Semite who hated every single Jew he ever saw. That was just simply not true. He was more than willing to cooperate with the Zionists, as were the Zionists very willing to cooperate with the Nazis to accomplish their goal of stealing Palestinian land. But he even saved many Jews by working with them in this way. And so in this way, Eichmann was not only a cog in the machine, he was an architect alongside key Zionists, insofar as we are looking at expulsion here. Where in the 1930s, there were tensions in Germany between Zionist and non-Zionist Jews. The former sometimes cooperated with the Nazis, like the Zionist Jews sometimes cooperated with the Nazis because they shared this dream of Jewish exile, where in her words, Zionists, according to the Nazis, were the decent Jews, since they too thought in national terms. Because of course we know of the Nazis, they were hyper-nationalists, believing in, you know, the German spirit and everything like this, wanting to defend the motherland and the Reich. They saw in Zionist Jews a bit of themselves, this hyper-nationalism, no matter what, you know, what price others would pay, that the Palestinians would pay by stealing their land, displacing 800,000 of them just so that the Jews could have a home there. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but Zionist Jews assumed the status of being non-assimilationist, where there were most Jews saw their home in Germany and Poland and Hungary, like that's where their home was. They wanted to live there. And to the Zionist Jews, they were seen as being not legitimate because they didn't share in the Zionist aspiration of having this home in the, you know, quote unquote, Holy Land for them. And this, I'm just speculating, but maybe this is the root or the origin point in its like material exercise in the world of this belief that if a Jewish person opposes Zionism, then they are not a proper Jew. They're called a self-hating Jew. Or the Zionists will say that they're not Jewish at all. As though the only possible way somebody of the Jewish faith could have an attachment to their spirituality, to divinity, to the cosmos, to everything, is filtered through a state. Like, what? And then on top of all of this, there were the emissaries from Palestine who arrived in Germany to enlist help for the illegal immigration of Jews into British-ruled Palestine. And both the Gestapo and the SS were very, very helpful to these emissaries. Where the biggest threat wasn't the German authorities, but actually the British colonizers who occupied the land. And this is a broader issue where Jewish people have been living in Palestine for millennia, just like in so many other parts of the world. Like, that's just how it works. And many of them, or some of them, were trying to also usher in more Jews to that land, to quote-unquote return to that land. And at the time, British colonizers, because British rule was, they had rule over the territory there, they were actually kind of restrictive of how this was happening. And so Zionists saw the British as being more of a hindrance to them than the Nazis, who were more than willing to participate. Which is like, I thought the Nazis were this ultimate evil anti-Semitic force, which indeed, I think they were. But it's really important to see at what point anti-Semitism is willing to be put aside to accomplish other ends. Now, these details barely emerged in the court case in Jerusalem because the defense didn't see it as relevant, and Eichmann demonstrated an embarrassingly weak memory. And this, Hannah Arendt just cannot make sense of this, why any of these details weren't included. Where he even tried to visit Palestine and made it to Haifa before the British sent him to Egypt when he was visited by Jewish military people. Again, this flies in the face of this idea that Eichmann was this ultimate evil anti-Semitic monster where his only goal was to exterminate the Jewish people. At least that was the narrative that was being spouted in the Jerusalem court, which was not true. Now, by 1939, the Nazis had abandoned their Zionist aspirations, more or less, and turned to concentration. That is, they were going to then move Jews not out of Europe, or try to move them out, but to concentrate them, because it took so many resources and money to actually send people to Palestine. Now, at least in part. Between 39 and 41, though, the National Socialists ran the Reich Association that appointed Jews to help deport Jews. So this was still going on. Like, it didn't just end. But they would actually adopt here, really in more full force, their second solution, that is concentration. And that puts us here into Chapter 5, the second solution, concentration. Now, when the Nazis began sending Jews to concentration camps in 1939, they adopted the rhetoric of objectivity, quote-unquote objectivity, by calling it administration. And they when they resorted to extermination, they called it, quote-unquote, economy. Really horrendous, horrifying stuff. To effectively whitewash these horrors and make sure that the public didn't really know about it. Although that's, you know, up for debate how much they actually knew about it. At least at what point they would learn about it. But the adoption of this rhetoric, this effort to whitewash the Nazi horrors, was also, it was made apparent in the trial when even the lawyer framed the system, like, as horrifying as this is, Eichmann's lawyer framed the systematic murder of Jews as a quote-unquote medical matter because the gas was prepared by physicians and, like, calculated as to how much would be used in order to kill people, like, obviously horrifying details. And he tried to use this argument to essentially defang really the horrors of the SS's culpability to pretend as though this is like an administrative medical practice and though the people who are actually designing it weren't responsible, which is my God. Now in 1941, the Jewish question extended through nearly every branch of the Nazi party, and so Eichmann's importance declined. As it turns out, the extension of the Jewish question throughout the Nazi ranks posed problems for Eichmann's prosecutors, because he could hardly be singled out. Because, just to be clear, like, the Jerusalem court was trying to frame him as the sole architect behind the final solution, or like one of the primary figures, but that was so far from the truth. The dude had barely any ability to organize anything himself, let alone the mass murder and execution of Jews, Roma people, disabled people, and so on. He was just, quote-unquote, following orders. Doesn't mean he's not culpable, but it didn't resonate with the actual trial or what was being tried here. And all of these branches of the SS, they were all united in their effort to kill as many Jews as possible. Like, they were all participating in this, and with other states. I can't say that Poland did, because I don't want to get in trouble, because it's against the law. But, so, you know, I guess not. Maybe look it up if you're curious. But other states, certainly, and it was orchestrated not just at the, like, federal level, but at smaller levels where Jews were being taken from their home by like militia groups all throughout Europe, being murdered and executed, but like horrendous stuff. This was all going on too, way outside of Eichmann's purview, way outside of even the Nazi regime, like it, just how widespread it was. And I think I mentioned last time, but I didn't talk about it, is like, and I just think it's so important to talk about, is that I firmly believe that there is a veritable rise in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and anti-Semitism today. Like, no doubt. I spend enough time on X to see it. Like, I know that it exists. This is a, and it has to be dealt with. And it assumes many forms. Like, we're seeing how what Israel's doing to Palestine and Palestinians, some people are treating that as the broader project of a Jewish effort to take over the world. Or how the relative media silence about it, or the media, the Western media classes aligning itself with the Israeli regime, are, you know, people are reading this as, oh, it is run by the Jews, like the media is, and so many other things. Obviously, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and they have to be challenged. One of the difficulties in actually challenging them, though, is when protesters opposing Israel's relentless bombardment and violence of Palestinians is called anti-Semitism. What's getting in the way of us challenging and holding these people accountable in all of their anti-Semitism is associating any effort to be anti-Zionist, any opposition to Zionism, as anti-Semitism. Where we're seeing this as well, with hundreds of Jewish protesters being arrested in their effort to protest the Israeli regime. Like, how is that not perceived by the Israeli regime, by any of these big Israel-sponsored organizations? How are they not crying about that being anti-Semitism? Arresting Jewish students peacefully protesting, or Jewish people, not just students, peacefully protesting against Israel's violence against Palestinians. Like, why is it that in some cases violence against Jews is taken to be the absolute and or in case not even violence against Jews, like using the phrase from the river to the sea is taken as the like ultimate anti-Semitic slur, but arresting Jews isn't? Like physically arresting them, harassing them, and even in Israel as well, where Orthodox Jews are being arrested, beaten by police, and that's not perceived as anti-Semitism. But from the river to the seas, I can't explain it. And this is one of the difficulties that, you know, researchers, that people who are actually concerned about anti-Semitism face when everything is just reduced to anti-Semitism that does not comply with the Israeli regime's agenda. Anything that opposes it is just taken to be anti-Semitism. It works. This is great for Israel, not so great for Judaism. And this puts us here into chapter 6, the final solution, killing, where Russia's declaration of war sped up, it hastened Germany's plans for the Jews and pushed them to abandon most plans for Jewish resettlements. So when they were participating in concentration, they were setting up concentration camps in a lot of the East, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Germany as well. Of course, I've been to Dachau. Like, horrifying experience. I think, you know, it's a hard thing to say to be like, I think it's something everyone should experience is to visit a concentration camp, because it's horrifying. But, you know, I've had that experience and seen how horrifying this place was. And yeah, I mean, it's one of the most horrifying places to be in. And all of these camps were being set up mostly in the east, from Poland, Hungary, Romania, but not just there, of course, but the death camps certainly more concentrated in that area. And this happened to be in line with like Russia's retaliatory path, where they were going to have to move through these eastern countries to arrive at Germany's doorstep. And so this is what hastened. They were like, we can't keep holding these people here. This is what sped up their adopting the final solution, knowing full well that they weren't going to be able to keep these people here. They had to do something with them, and they couldn't send them away. And so here we get the final solution, as horrifying as that is. Now, in July 1941, Heinrich, summoned Eichmann to Berlin to tell him about the final solution, and this disturbed Eichmann. Like, at least according to his testimony, according to other people's testimonies, Eichmann didn't want to employ the final solution. He didn't think that that was necessary, and he didn't like the idea of killing people. Eichmann was simply, he was simply on a need-to-know basis. Like, he wasn't the architect of the final solution. He just received these orders and didn't know about this, even though higher-ranked officials had been talking about it long before. He was totally kept out of the loop. He was kept in the dark. Now, on the topic of orders, little evidence suggests Eichmann gave orders to the camps to erect and to enact the final solution, to set up the death chambers. Eichmann was responsible for inspecting the gas chambers and gas trucks in the east, and doing so made him emotionally unwell. When he actually did go to the east to inspect these places, he describes how badly it affected him and how negatively it affected him to go and observe what they had planned for the Jews. And I mentioned gas trucks. Maybe a little less or known detail is that the Jews are exterminated not only in concentration camps and the death camps, they're also exterminated in firing squads and other horrendous methods, but they were also, in all of the Nazis' evil, placed into trucks with the same gas system set up as was set up in the death camps, and they'd be loaded into trucks and driven out into the forest, into where they could be dumped into mass graves, and they would die on the way as they were filled, as their cabin or the compartment they were in was filled with gas. Like, really horrendous stuff. And it goes to show, like, the, you know, I hope you can tolerate my using this word, but the rationality behind the Holocaust. Like, this was, and this is why I think Adorno, who was Jewish, was very right in the way that he thought about the Enlightenment, where the Enlightenment is offered as this, like, oh, this beacon of human progress and brilliance, the adoption of science and logic and rationality, and everything will be good. But then we see this on full display, this adoption of these strategies of rationality, math, organization, calculation, used to exterminate people into oblivious anonymity, like to just eradicate people en masse. We're to the point that we can't even get like an actually accurate number as to how many Jews died. It's like around 6 million, but the actual number, we don't know. There's so many we'll never be able to account for. It could be way more, you know. So many we'll never be able to account for because they were just so systematically eradicated. And he, beyond being tasked to go and inspect the gas chambers and the gas trucks in the east, he was actually sent to Russia, the Russian territory, to see how the Jews were being massacred by firing squad, to see if that was a feasible method as well. And he complained about these horrors. Like, he couldn't stomach the idea at all, and how he couldn't handle them. He complained to his superiors that this was not a good thing to do. Now, as we mentioned earlier, the case was foolproof, right? Like, everyone knows that Eichmann was culpable and he deserved exactly what he got. The problems that the prosecution confronted, though, were whether Eichmann was just following orders to save his own life, and or if he had tried secretly to mitigate Nazi genocide of Jewish people. Now, if you remember from the first episode, I made it clear that Eichmann thought he wasn't really guilty in the terms of the indictment, which is to say that, like, he didn't kill anybody, that he claims. He didn't kill anyone, and there was no proof that he actually killed anyone, so he didn't see himself as being responsible in the way that the Jerusalem court was trying to make him seem responsible. Did he still think that he had done wrong and evil? Yes, I think he did think that. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't in his head. And I think everyone else thought that, and I think that they are right. But here the question is whether or not Eichmann could have said, I was just following orders because if I didn't, they were going to kill me. And that's an entirely different can of worms. That's an entirely different beast to deal with something like that. And it's something that many other upper-ranking SS officials had actually claimed. Because they were like, if I didn't do this, I was going to be killed. Now, after all, many Jewish people who aided the Nazis used this case as well. Like, they argued that, you know, if they didn't participate, they were going to be killed. Now, there were, of course, Sonderkommandos, there was Group 13, there was the Judenrat, who worked in Nazi ghettos, also known as the Jewish Elders, to essentially help the Nazis. And some of them would have been killed if they didn't. But certainly not all of them. Now, in Eichmann's case, he was not under threat of death for disobeying. Like, this was not something that, if he'd had disobeyed, he wasn't going to be put to death. At least the records, the historical contingencies don't seem to suggest that. That others who'd done the same, who'd refused to take orders or anything, they weren't put to death. However, it seems like he did take steps to lessen the violence. It did seem like, although he wasn't just doing it to defend his own life, it did seem like he did take actual steps to save Jewish lives. Where Arendt describes that the only time Eichmann seems to have acted of his own volition, because other, like in other cases, she's clear that he's like a thoughtless, uncritical, uncreative, just husk of a person. Arendt describes that the only time that he seems to have acted of his own volition and not just listening and following orders was in 1941 when he ordered to deport 20,000 Jews to Russia, where they would have been killed instantly. Instead, though, he diverted the transport. He diverted it, even though he got these orders, to the Lodz ghetto, where there was not infrastructure to kill them. At the Lodz ghetto, the death camps, the gas chambers had not been yet set up, and he knew that. And he knew that if they had gone to Russia, as the orders told him, then they would have died. That would have been it. And he said, no, we're going to send them to the Lutz ghetto instead, knowing full well that the infrastructure to eradicate them was not yet established because he hoped to buy them time. And is this Hannah Arendt trying to defend Eichmann? No, she knows that he's culpable for this violence. She knows that he's culpable in his role in the Nazi Holocaust, but he was not this designer architect as the Jerusalem court made it out to seem. And we actually do a disservice to understanding what she calls the banality of evil, like just how banal it is. Like, people following orders commit the worst atrocities, or at least we see here, commit some of the worst atrocities, and we lose sight of that when we turn them into these ultra evil monsters that are all these like evil geniuses guided by their own prejudice and discrimination that they're able to just compartmentalize and translate into this like perfectly running extermination machine, which is not the case for Eichmann. Now, like, was he actually opposed to the Nazi regime? No, he didn't participate in the Nazi run plot to try and kill Hitler, which, by the way, the effort to assassinate Hitler was hardly inspired by a desire to protect the Jews. Like, these were ultra-conservatives in any case within the Nazi ranks who thought that Hitler was going too far and kind of screwing up their Germany's image on the world stage, and it would result in Germany's decimation. Like, that's what they were worried about. They didn't care about the Jews. They were all anti-Semites as well. I don't know, I guess I can't say that. Maybe some of them weren't, but I assume most of them were. All anti-Semites, not guided by an effort to protect Jews. So it just is, you know, a history lesson. Because I think this event, this effort to try and assassinate Hitler is really romanticized. Like, these people were trying to do good. Like, no. They were just, they wanted to do the same things, largely, without the grandiose, megalomaniac strategy of Hitler. And it's really hard to imagine the Jews being much better off if they had succeeded. Like, maybe they would have. Maybe they would have dialed back the final solution. Like, I don't know. But, the anti-Semitism was not going to be much, much better. After all, anti-Semitism, like I said, it was rampant throughout Europe. And the Germans were no strangers to extermination. Where before the Jews' mass slaughter after 1941, Hitler had ordered the mentally ill, the Roma people, Catholics, communists, Russian functionaries, all to be slaughtered. Like, and this was widely accepted, especially in the case of disabled people, where between 1939 and 1941, Germany had used gas chambers and gas to exterminate approximately 50,000 disabled people because they were a drain on the system. Like, and people knew about this. At least Hannah Arendt speculates. She's like, there's no way that people did not know about this. It was just so common, this idea. And she cites this one moment or this one interview with the German person around the time where they'd used the image or the threat of gassing to describe their own fears of something else, of like the German government even coming after them. So they knew full well that this was a common practice among the German officials against people that they didn't like. So again, I mean, it just doesn't seem like if the Hitler conspiracy or the conspiracy against Hitler had succeeded, then it would have been much better for Jews or for anyone else for that matter. Like, maybe it would have. Again, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, but it doesn't seem like it. Now, Eichmann, and it wasn't just Eichmann, but the use of gas is so horrendous, but they justified it because they thought it was more humanitarian than shooting them, where they could almost be surprised by the gas and they would be killed quickly and not know it was going to happen, and then that would be it. It doesn't make it any better. But this is what they told themselves to make themselves feel better about it. Like, that's how horrendous they are. And there's, this is part of Derrida's critique of Benjamin, where in Benjamin's critique of violence, he talks about, like, ending violence and replacing it with a... I'm going to just butcher it here. I've done an episode on it, but it was so many years ago, I don't remember the details. But he's calling for, like, the end of violence, and this is someone who was murdered. He died by suicide to avoid being captured by the Nazis, because he was going to be captured by the Nazis and then sent to the death camps. He describes how in his critique of violence, how it's important to get away from these really violent forms of violence, like a brutal murder, to replace it with these more perfected forms of violence. That's not exactly what he's saying. But then Derrida, later on, you know, who actually understands the text, is like, dude, you're pretty much just... He's not being this mean to Benjamin, who was essentially murdered by the Nazis in his effort to escape the Nazis. Like, Derrida says, you're pretty much just justifying the Nazi strategy here, which is, go and check out those episodes if you want, but yeah, it's kind of haunting. At least what I mean is haunting is that these people used gas to make themselves feel better about mass murder. Horrifying stuff. But it was used as it was used against disabled people. I mean, this is just further evidence that the final solution and the way that the Jews were murdered, most of them, with gas chambers, like, this had nothing to do with Eichmann. This is much bigger than him. Where protests brought an end to the discriminate murder of the mentally ill, but we didn't see the same protests when Jews were being gassed. And again, how much did the people actually know about Jews being murdered? It's hard to say. But the common explanation is because of the secrecy, though. However, it seems like everyday Germans were fully aware of Germany's use of gas as a military tactic. Again, whether or not that actually translates to knowledge about the treatment of or the violence that was being inflicted against Jews, I mean, that's up in the air. And that puts us here into Chapter 7, the Wannsee Conference or Pontius Pilate. And the Wannsee Conference. So the Wannsee Conference was a conference with all ministers to coordinate them towards the final solution. This was the conference that was put together by the highest SS officials to bring together all the ministers to tell them about the final solution, to get them on board. Now, Heydrich didn't know what to expect. You know, he's one of the organizers here. He didn't know what to expect because the minister's views, they weren't always clear to him. And to his surprise, though, very much to his surprise, they were in overwhelming agreement. Like, they took to it very quickly, which is haunting. Now, then Eichmann got to work, because then he had this carte blanche to go ahead with the Nazis and Jewish police and Jewish Council of Elders to make this work. Where, and Hannah Arendt writes, without Jewish help and administrative and police work, the final solution of rounding up Jews in Berlin was done entirely by Jewish police. There would have been either complete chaos or an impossibly severe drain on German manpower. To a Jew, this role of the Jewish leaders in the destruction of their own people is undoubtedly the darkest chapter of the whole story. Which is, and we find, like, Raoul Hilberg accounts, like, talks about this a lot in his book, The Destruction of the European Jew. And, I mean, would I go so far as to say that this was the darkest chapter of the whole history? No. But probably that it happened in the first place and the Nazis were the ultimate culprit here is probably the thing to focus on. But in any case, is it a dark chapter? Is it one that demands way more people be held accountable? Yes. Does it demand that we understand the banality of evil to also include those people who are being victimized and how they participate to attain their own dreams of land on, you know, to steal it from the Palestinians? Yes. But in the face of all this, Eichmann was like, oh my God, all the ministers, all the SS officials, everyone seems to be on board. Even all these Jewish elders seem to be on board. And so he felt like, quote unquote, Pontius Pilate, where he could wipe himself of absolve himself of any guilt or feelings of guilt and be like, well, that everyone's on board. Everyone hates like killing Jesus. Everyone, we can just do it. No problem. Not to mention how they received so much support by non-Jewish allies to the Nazi party as well, like in Hungary, not Poland, because I can't say that, but other places as well. Now, one of the haunting tactics here was to take away Jews' statehood, wherever state that they belong to make it so that no nation would inquire and wonder about what was actually happening to them, which would be relevant when we look at Sweden. I believe it's the case of Sweden where when the Nazis started to work with Swedish authorities, the Swedish didn't know like what was actually happening to their people. They thought they were just being sent away. And when they actually inquired about it, they're like, oh my God, like not to defend them. But that history is worth recounting. So in Eichmann's own words, he was able to quell his guilty conscience by observing that no one around him, no one at all, who actually was against the final solution. The exception was a Dr. Kostner, with whom Eichmann negotiated releasing 1 million Jews and who expressed that he wished Auschwitz would halt its murderous rampage. And this is like, obviously horrendous stuff, but for the most part, he saw himself among like-minded people. And so he was able to be like, well, I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. Now, in the case of wealthy and powerful Jews, they helped track Jewish people's property, movement, and force their displacement. Now, of course, the Israeli court ignored all these details. Now, when confronted with H.G. Adler's, there in Sidat, like his recount of that concentration camp, again, the pronunciation I'm going to mess up, Der Seinstadt, 1941 to 1945, the prosecution was forced to acknowledge, albeit without much consequences, the role of Jewish leaders in facilitating the Nazi capture of Jewish people. Now, it's worth noting that Adler's approach is much more nuanced than Arendt's. Like, Adler is not pointing the finger or placing nearly as much blame against Jewish leaders. But it doesn't mean that I don't think Arendt is right or that these people shouldn't have been held accountable as well. But Adler's approach is much more nuanced because believe it or not, I do a fair amount of research when I do this stuff. Like, I actually go and confirm. That's why it takes me forever. Go and confirm as many of the facts as I can find information about. And if I ever get anything wrong, like, please tell me. And then I'll make sure that I don't make the mistake again. And Adler even played a significant yet secret part in Eichmann's trial, where he was interviewed secretly to testify against him. But that's another story. And if you want another resource, or if you're curious about even more of this, there's also Michel Mazur's The Vanished City, Everyday Life in the Warsaw Ghetto, that reads that Jews who entered Jewish councils became Jewish Führers, like Mein Führer, like Hitler, that were completely indifferent to the terrible suffering of the Jewish masses. And that's The Vanished City by Michel Mazur, who writes that. Because again, I mean, I went and looked this stuff up, read up on this, like, and this is part of the history we don't get, and that I think it's really important to also know about to properly understand all of the nuance and not just pin all of this on Eichmann, even though he deserves everything that he got, as the court found him guilty. Now, all of these details work to blur the line between culprit and victim and to extend culpability beyond Eichmann. Like, but again, he was indeed culpable. Surely such details would have been more relevant than in the case of the court that was just a spectacular recitation or, like, repetition of the horrors of the Holocaust. Surely these details would have been more relevant than just witness after witness testifying about the horrors of the Holocaust in the East that Eichmann had no part of at all in the death camps, like nothing at all. But that's not what the point of the trial was. It was clearly, it was meant to be a spectacle, meant to justify Israel's existence at the expense of Palestinians. And they would also repeat stories of, like, the Warsaw Ghetto without ever mentioning, like Mazur does, these Jewish Führers that were, again, in his words, completely indifferent to the terrible suffering of the Jewish masses, where, and this extends to the Jewish Council that we've already mentioned, the Jewish police, and the Nazis, and non-Jewish allies to the Nazis, where Arendt speculates that these testimonies were probably meant to convey, in her words, that whatever resistance there had been had come from Zionists, which, oh my God, not true. The testimony substance conflicted with this hope, as they revealed Jewish resistance fighters were not Zionists. Most were people who were like, this is my home, who didn't want to leave, especially in Warsaw, who weren't interested in just going somewhere else. And the point of the Israeli court here was to kind of to tell the tale differently, to rewrite the history, to make the Zionists seem as though they were righteous in this whole thing, when they were not. And all of this flies in the face of the common explanation of the Holocaust as being due to the fact that the Jews were leaderless and stateless. Where Hannah Arendt says that, not in her words quite yet, she's like, the second is true. They were indeed stateless. There was no Jewish state. But the first is not. They had leaders. In fact, Arendt goes so far as to say that if the Jewish people had really been unorganized, if they did not have leaders, the total number of victims would hardly have been between 4.5 and 6 million Jews that I alluded to earlier. Like this quote earlier. Like, it's a terrible lie to suggest that they were leaderless. And it was actually because of that leadership that it was so easy for the Nazis to do this. The cooperation of their leaders facilitated Jewish extermination, where the Nazis also capitalized on distinctions in the Jewish community, like between Eastern and Western Jews, German and Polish Jews, Zionist, non-Zionist Jews, wealthy and poor Jews, veteran Jews, non-veteran Jews. And this also plays into her broader thesis, or one of her points in The Origins of Totalitarianism, to say that Jewish leaders adopted what she calls race thinking, you know, understanding their people in terms of race, to be able to create distinctions that would justify who to send to the concentration camps, who to send to Palestine, who to do whatever else with. Like, they adopted this scientific racism in order to facilitate these decisions, to make these choices, where Jews who saw their home in Europe, Germany, and Poland, Hungary, wherever, they were seen as being less pure than those Jews who wanted to go to Palestine, to the Holy Land. Like it, and this is something that I was always a little uncomfortable with, even in the origins of totalitarianism. And if you listen to my episodes on it, I think I just flat out say, I'm like, I don't feel comfortable with this. But it starts to make a whole lot more sense now, reading Eichmann and Jerusalem and actually really grappling with the role of Jewish leaders in aiding the Nazis and more broadly understanding the state of anti-Semitism all throughout Europe and the world. Where we need to look no further than the Kastner report, that according to the Holocaust Encyclopedia, because again, I, you know, do this research, details how he prioritized quote-unquote wealthy Jews, Zionist leaders, prominent rabbis, and his own friends and family to send to Palestine, like, at the expense of countless other Jews. How is that not anti-Semitism? You know? Yeah, that'll bring us to the end of chapter 7. We'll wrap this up here, and next time pick up with chapter 8. If you like what I did, you can like, share, subscribe, donate to one of the organizations below if you can, if you have the means. If there's anything I got wrong, please let me know. If there's anything I omitted, please let me know. I'd love to hear about it. And yeah, on that note, take care.